Good morning. My name is Nadia, and I'll be the conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Paramount Global's Q1 2023 earnings conference call. At this time, all lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there'll be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star followed by two. In order to get as many of your questions as possible, we ask that you please limit yourselves to one question. At this time, I would now like to turn the call over to Kristin Southey, Paramount Global's EVP Investor Relations. Kristin, you may now begin your conference call.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for taking the time to join us for our first quarter 2023 earnings call. Joining me for today's discussion are Bob Bakish, our President and CEO, and Naveen Chopra, our CFO. Please note that in addition to our earnings release, we have trending schedules containing supplemental information available on our website. Before we start this morning, I want to remind you that certain statements made on this call are forward-looking statements that involve risks and uncertainties. These risks and uncertainties are discussed in more detail in our filings with the SEC. Some of today's financial remarks will focus on adjusted results. Reconciliations of these non-GAAP financial measures can be found in our earnings release or in our trending schedules, which contain supplemental information and in each case can be found in the investor relations section of our website. Now I will turn the call over to Bob.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Today, my remarks will cover Q1 highlights as well as some perspective on the balance of the year. Let me start with the big picture. The media landscape is evolving, and we are executing on our plan to transform Paramount with it. We're leveraging our traditional media base, both financially and operationally, to invest in, build, and scale a set of streaming networks for the 21st century with a robust content engine at the core, all in service of delivering long-term value to our shareholders. We're also navigating a challenging and uncertain macroeconomic environment, and you see the impact of that in our financials as the combination of peak streaming investment intersects with cyclical ad softness. All of this makes us even more focused on making the necessary decisions to return the company to earnings growth and positive free cash flow in 2024. To that end, we continue to hone our cost structure, align resources with growth areas, and divest non-core assets. Because at the fundamental level, our strategy is working and our momentum is strong. We are producing popular content, adding subscribers, increasing engagement, growing streaming revenue, and progressing towards key business objectives. As we do that, we see several things that encourage us. First, we are seeing signs of stabilization in the ad market. Perhaps more importantly, we're seeing the unquestionable and growing value of our content and platforms to both the consumer and business community, as exemplified by growing usage as well as a broadening range of deals and partnerships. Paramount is transforming. We are confident in the company's execution, and shareholder value creation remains our top priority. With that, let's dive in. I'll begin with a look at our popular content, the foundation of Paramount, and the engine that's powered our company for decades. Today, that engine is stronger than ever. It's this content that underpins our D2C momentum, where revenue grew 39% year-over-year to an annual run rate of more than $6 billion. This quarter, we reached two big global milestones for our flagship streaming services. Paramount+ grew to 60 million total subscribers, adding 4.1 million subs, while Pluto TV hit 80 million monthly active users. Importantly, both are resonating globally, not just in the U.S. Paramount+ saw a 65% year-over-year revenue increase, while total global viewing hours across Paramount+ and Pluto TV increased over 50% year-over-year and over 20% sequentially. Viewers don't just subscribe to Paramount+ or watch Pluto TV because of a single hit. They come for our broad, bold slate of content, the film franchises they crave, the news they rely on, and the TV series and sporting events they're obsessed with. In the quarter, we saw Paramount+ subscriber growth driven by newly released originals like Tulsa King, Mayor of Kingstown, 1923, and Teen Wolf: The Movie, as well as from theatrical movies like Top Gun Maverick, and sports like the NCAA and UEFA Champions League soccer. And on Pluto, we see the engagement of our broad and deep libraries led by the CBS brand, as well as great content we source from third parties. In Q1, the Paramount Plus with Showtime bundle also benefited from strong Showtime content, including Your Honor and Yellowjackets. Not only were they both top acquisition drivers in the quarter, the two shows also dominated consumption, driving nearly 30% of the hours streamed on Showtime. This thanks to their devoted, enthusiastic fan bases. We see this as an extremely good sign as Paramount Plus is about to transition to Paramount Plus with Showtime. Looking at the quarter more broadly, CBS programming strongly attracts viewers across linear and streaming. To illustrate the power of CBS, I'd note that CBS programming accounted for 281 billion minutes of viewing in the quarter. That's nearly 50% more than the closest broadcast competitor, and nearly four times more than the combined total minutes spent watching original content on Amazon, Hulu, Disney Plus, and HBO Max, a testament to the power and scale of CBS content. I'd also note that CBS, with its powerful entertainment lineup, essential news offerings, and marquee sports, is on track to be the most watched broadcast network for the 15th consecutive season. And in film, Paramount Pictures released the latest installment of the Scream franchise, Scream 6, which opened at number one in March and is now the highest grossing installment domestically in the franchise. This, to us, is yet another example of the power of our franchises and how that power keeps growing. And it's not just a theatrical story. It extends to streaming too, with Scream 6 debuting on Paramount Plus on April 25th to great results. More on its performance next quarter. Big picture, our franchises deliver consistently excellent content and drive high fan base engagement, advantages that you will see play out again and again as we look ahead. But it's not just content. It's how do we go to market and deploy that content, including in streaming. Since launch, our streaming strategy has been built on a dual revenue stream model, one that spans both subscription and advertising, and benefits from strong, innovative partnerships with iconic brands. To that end, we are very happy with our Walmart partnership, and we're thrilled it now includes Pluto TV. And in March, Paramount Plus launched on the subscription hub for Verizon Plus Play customers. This partnership is another step forward as we continue to introduce third-party partnerships to deliver ubiquitous distribution to consumers. And coming soon, Delta loyalty members on planes originating in the U.S. will have access to a special free trial of the Paramount Plus premium service. Members will have the opportunity to customize their in-flight entertainment experience via Paramount Plus on their personal mobile device with big, broad, and beloved hits across every genre. These powerful partnerships represent just one component of a multifaceted strategy, a strategy that has led to a streaming business with total revenue that's more than double what it was 2 years ago, and a subscriber base on Paramount Plus alone that has grown over 3.5 times since launch. This business is, in fact, scaling at a rapid rate, and one that benefits from a TAM that is much bigger than TV. Yes, this takes investment, and as we've described, 2023 represents our peak investment year. But there is no question that our investment is producing results, and as we scale, we are very much on a related path to streaming profitability. Advertising, the health of the market, and where we are in the cycle is a topic of industry conversation. As I mentioned earlier, there are signs of stabilization in the ad market. We like what we are seeing in many categories, and we like what we are seeing in the direct side of digital. And as the market continues to turn, ad growth will improve. As it does, we are confident that the strength of our multi-platform strategy puts us in a unique position to capitalize on it, something my recent conversations with agency and client leaders during our series of upfront events has me more convinced of than ever. We have the right strategy, assets, and team in place to succeed in the evolving landscape. For example, IQ, our integrated suite of streaming and creative ad solutions, helps brands place ads across all of our digital platforms, with a combined reach of 90 million full-episode monthly unique viewers. This proprietary advertising product is built on our investments in Pluto and Paramount Plus, and it is a product whose reach has grown more than 50% in 2 years, whose ad tech and targeting capabilities are advancing at a rapid pace. That is only one example. And across our company, there's no question that our investments are creating compelling, sought-after products for consumers, advertisers, and distributors. But at the same time, we recognize how these investments, on top of the macroeconomic headwinds that have impacted the ad market, also impact earnings and our balance sheet in the short term. So, with creating shareholder value and financial flexibility as fundamental goals, we're deploying three key tactics, all of which Naveen will provide additional color on. First, we are implementing significant cost-saving measures across certain parts of our business. Second, we're assessing and executing on the value creation opportunities associated with the divestiture of non-core assets, like with respect to Simon & Schuster, where we have restarted the sale process. Finally, we are amending our dividend policy. This decision will further enhance our ability to deliver long-term value for our shareholders as we move towards streaming profitability. As we look ahead, we're producing popular content across genres and platforms. And while the writer's strike may cause some disruption, we are confident in our ability to manage through it, given the many levers we have to pull. We will continue to deploy content across platforms in an efficient way, from theatrical movies that create revenue at the box office then move to Paramount Plus, to CBS Entertainment news and sports content, which drives massive reach and engagement in broadcast and in streaming, and more. This multi-platform approach starts with our strong upcoming theatrical film slate, including four franchises in just the next 4 months: the highly anticipated Transformers Rise of the Beast in June, the return of Tom Cruise in July in Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, Seth Rogen's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem in August, and Paw Patrol The Mighty Movie in September, all of which have incredible buzz, including coming out of last week's CinemaCon in Vegas. Paramount Plus is increasingly a destination for excellent streaming content. Sure, the films I just mentioned will make their way to Paramount Plus after a theatrical run, but there is much more than that to it. Fatal Attraction just debuted on the platform, and we're excited to release Taylor Sheridan's next show, Special Ops Lioness, starring Zoe Saldana with Morgan Freeman and Nicole Kidman in the summer. We will also shortly see the unscripted side of Sylvester Stallone in The Family Stallone. And in sports, the combination of CBS and Paramount Plus has a strong slate coming, including the UEFA Champions League final and all of the PGA Tour's FedEx Playoff Cup events, followed by Big Ten football later in the year, accompanying the return of the NFL and SEC. Likewise, news will power engagement both on CBS and Paramount Plus, including favorites like CBS Mornings, which has been consistently growing share. And from Nickelodeon Studios, we'll have all new series and movies based on classic Nick properties, including Good Burger 2, Zoe 102, The Thundermans, and The Loud House, coming to Paramount Plus and Nickelodeon Linear. Finally, we are thrilled to begin to bring the integrated Paramount Plus with Showtime product to market this summer, a game-changing multi-platform offering we are very excited about. This product will integrate Paramount Plus content with the Showtime slate, including highly successful series like The Chi, which will be returning for season 6 this summer, along with a collection of Showtime franchises as we look to the balance of the year and early 24. So once again, there's a lot here for the whole household, and that will drive subs and engagement as Paramount Plus rapidly becomes a cornerstone streaming service. Before I hand it off to Naveen, I want to close by underscoring what remains our top priority, generating long-term shareholder value. From our franchise-fueled content slate, to our innovative partnerships, to the powerful scale of our platforms, this is a company that knows its strengths, knows how to build on them, and one that is positioned to succeed. including as the macro environment continues to stabilize, which makes us excited about the path ahead. And with that, I'll hand it over to Naveen.
Thank you, Bob. Good morning, everyone. Our Q1 results reflect a combination of strong momentum from Paramount Content, investment in our D2C business, and the continued impact of macro headwinds. Today, I'm going to cover three things. First, I'll provide additional color on a few elements of our Q1 results. Second, I will talk about optimizing our capital allocation. And third, I'll discuss our expectations for earnings and free cash flow improvement in the back half of this year and into 2024. In Q1, we delivered total company revenue of $7.3 billion and adjusted OIBDA of $548 million. Our press release includes a comprehensive review of key financial and operational results for the quarter. I'm going to focus my comments here on four specific areas: affiliate and subscription revenue, advertising, our filmed entertainment results, and cash flow. Affiliate and subscription revenue growth accelerated to 12% this quarter, continued evidence that the ecosystem shift from pay TV to streaming yields material growth for our business. Notably, we saw improving trends in both linear and streaming. On the linear side, TV media affiliate revenue declined 1% year over year, an improvement versus Q4. And in streaming, D2C subscription revenue was up 50% year over year. Paramount Plus subscription revenue saw even stronger growth, driven by subscriber additions, an increase in ARPU, and improvements in domestic churn. Looking ahead, we expect healthy levels of year-over-year affiliate and subscription revenue growth to continue over the next several quarters, aided in part by the integration of Showtime and Paramount Plus. From a subscriber perspective, we expect net adds in Q2 will be seasonally soft ahead of the release of key content titles and marketing initiatives aligned with the rollout of the integrated service, which will occur throughout Q3 and Q4. Now let's turn to advertising. The global ad market continued to experience weakness in Q1, resulting in a 7% decline in total advertising revenue. This consisted of 15% growth in D2C advertising and an 11% decline in TV media advertising. The decline in TV media was impacted by international markets and fewer NFL games than in the prior year. However, we are seeing signs of market stabilization. Within the domestic ad market, sports remains an area of strength. We also saw improvement in key buying categories, including pharmaceuticals, food and beverage, travel, and auto, though categories like insurance, web services, and big tech remain relatively weak. With respect to Q2, we expect the year-over-year trend in TV media advertising to be slightly favorable to what we reported in Q1. And in D2C advertising, we expect continued acceleration. Related to digital advertising, Pluto TV hit a new milestone in Q1, reaching 80 million MAUs. We're proud of this milestone, and we expect global MAU growth to continue. However, the key driver of Pluto's future revenue growth will be the strong engagement trends we're seeing. In fact, total viewing hours on Pluto increased 35% in Q1 after growing nearly 20% in 2022. Going forward, we'll provide updates on engagement rather than reporting quarterly MAUs, as we believe this is more indicative of Pluto's revenue growth opportunity. Moving on to filmed entertainment, revenue and OIBDA were down versus the prior year, due in part to the timing and performance of the film slate. In terms of timing, Dungeons & Dragons Honor Among Thieves was released on the last day of the quarter, such that expenses were incurred without significant revenue contribution. And in terms of performance, Q1 included Operation Fortune from Miramax, which contributed to lower profitability of the film slate relative to the prior year. Filmed entertainment OIBDA was also negatively impacted by macro-driven softness in consumer products licensing. Looking ahead to Q2, filmed entertainment revenue and OIBDA will be down significantly versus the prior year, due to the tough comp against Top Gun Maverick. This year, Q2 will include Transformers Rise of the Beasts, our next big franchise film, which will be released on June 9th. The quarter will also include significant marketing expenses related to Mission Impossible, which will be released in early Q3. As a result of these timing dynamics, we expect a filmed entertainment OIBDA loss in Q2 that will be somewhat better than Q1. Given that the expenses for our biggest films this year are weighted to the front half, we expect significant improvement in filmed entertainment OIBDA in the back half of the year, driven by our strong lineup of franchise films, including Mission Impossible 7, Paw Patrol, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Moving on to cash flow. In Q1, free cash flow was a use of $554 million. This reflects our previously shared expectations for negative free cash flow for the full year 2023, with the first half of the year showing a use of capital and the back half of the year turning positive. The improvement in the back half will be driven by the timing of our film slate, streaming ARPU growth, and improvement in advertising trends. Now let's turn to capital allocation. As we've stated in the past, our capital allocation goals are threefold. First, we want to invest in organic growth. Second, we want to delever the balance sheet. And third, to return capital to shareholders. In order to continue to accomplish these goals in an uncertain macroeconomic environment, we're doing the following. First, with respect to organic growth, we're highly focused on efficiency. While growing our streaming business to an annual run rate of over $6 billion, we're capturing $700 million of future annual expense savings through the integration of Showtime. And as we progress through the integration, we're increasingly confident about our ability to get even more from our core franchise content investments and believe we will ultimately capture more than the $700 million in future expense savings. In fact, the programming charge incurred in Q1 illustrates our ability to concentrate content investments going forward. Second, we continue to manage net debt by divesting non-core assets. We have restarted the sale process for Simon & Schuster, and we see a path to potentially closing a transaction this year. The combination of initial interest and strong operating performance of the business over the last several years gives us confidence in our ability to maximize the value of this asset for our shareholders. With respect to capital returns, we will be reducing Paramount's quarterly dividend on common shares to 5 cents, or 20 cents annually. This change provides additional financial flexibility and enhances long-term value creation while continuing to return capital to shareholders. The dividend modification will be effective as of our next payment and will result in approximately $500 million of annualized cash savings. We believe this combination of actions across organic investment and expense reduction, non-core asset sales, and dividend policy reflect a prudent capital allocation strategy in an era which presents both macro uncertainty and tremendous growth opportunity. Finally, I'd like to address our path to earnings and free cash flow improvement, which starts with our world-class studios who continue to deliver popular franchise content and leverages our global distribution platforms to monetize content across theatrical, linear, streaming, and licensing channels. At the same time, we are keenly focused on commercial execution, which preserves the earnings and cash flow from our traditional TV media businesses while also narrowing D2C losses. And there are several key levers that enable us to accomplish these goals. At TV media, OIBDA will benefit from contractual rate increases as well as ongoing cost rationalization. Importantly, we expect to generate meaningful revenue and OIBDA in this large segment of our business for the foreseeable future. And in streaming, D2C earnings improvement will be driven by a combination of subscriber growth and ARPU expansion, as well as margin improvement unlocked by slowing growth in content expense and other operating efficiencies. Overall, we remain on track for peak streaming investment in 2023. In combination with continued cost optimization in our traditional business and recovery in the advertising marketplace, we're poised to deliver meaningful total company earnings growth and positive free cash flow in 2024. We have taken steps to build a stronger, leaner, more integrated One Paramount while positioning the company for earnings growth and value creation. With that, operator, let's open the line for questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypad. If you choose to withdraw your question, please press star followed by two. When preparing to ask your question, please ensure your phone is unmuted locally. We ask you please limit yourselves to one question. Our first question today goes to Michael Morris of Guggenheim. Michael, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you, guys. Good morning. Bob, first, maybe I'll ask you on direct-to-consumer. You've had strong subscriber and subscription growth, revenue growth, Paramount Plus. You know, as you look forward this year, can you expand a little bit more on the balance of subscriber growth and pricing power that you expect to drive, you know, that continued subscription revenue growth from here? And then I apologize, I have to ask a second, though. Naveen, you know, I need to ask you why now was the time to, you know, reduce the dividend so significantly. So, you know, based on your comments overall, it seems that the level of investment that you're going through is consistent with the plan you've had all along. And that dividend level is such an important outward signal of your sustained confidence. So I'm hoping you can dig in a little bit more and help us specifically with, you know, what drove that change now. Thank you, guys.
Sure, Mike. Let me start, and then I'll toss it to Naveen for a little more D2C and then the dividend piece. So, look, we're thrilled with the momentum we continue to see for Paramount Plus. We talked about the 60 million subscriber milestone in the quarter, and we do look to growth both on a subscriber side and, very importantly, a revenue side as we continue in the year and beyond. And that goes along the associated path to profitability. Focusing on Paramount Plus growth in the back half of the year, look, it starts with content. At the end of the day, Sumner said it, content is king. It is what people come to any media service for, including Paramount Plus. And you saw the success of our slate in the first quarter. And we feel really good about it for the balance of the year. And again, it's entertainment, which is a great driver of subscriber additions and engagement. It's news, which is more of an engagement vehicle, and it's sports, which has been great for us on both. As the year tracks out, the second quarter, for terms of subscriber addition, is probably seasonally a little softer, and then we pick it up in the back half of the year again. Part of that is, in the U.S., the combination of Paramount Plus with Showtime. We think that is clearly additive to the Paramount Plus sub base. But part of it is just the content slate writ large. Add to that the revenue side of this. Before I get to revenue, I want to also talk about the marketing. We continue to expand our partnership approach, including with Paramount Plus. The Walmart one is working very well for us. We're about to light up Delta. That's going to be interesting as well. So we're doing a bunch of stuff on the marketing side to add to it. And then go to revenue, ARPU. As you know, we are effectuating a price increase as we move forward in the summer. We feel really great about that. So the levers are in place to continue to drive Paramount Plus subscribers, revenue, and ultimately, you know, continue down this path to profitability. Naveen?
Yeah, thanks, Bob. And, Mike, I'll just add a few things on the D2C point and then address your question on the dividend. You know, as Bob said on D2C, this is a combination of subscriber growth as well as ARPU growth. Bob talked about a number of the drivers on those. I would just add, particularly with respect to ARPU, we continue to see growth there, both from favorable mix shift in terms of tiers, channels, geography. We're also seeing some good trends from an ad ARPU growth perspective. So that's going to continue to contribute to growth going forward. And it benefits from nice growth that we're seeing in terms of engagement, hours per sub, and the like. And then the pricing piece, which Bob mentioned, and I think is really worth reiterating, you know, all the pieces are in place for us to, I think, successfully raise pricing without a significant impact on churn and growth. You know, the value proposition for P+, both relative to other streaming services and traditional pay television, remains incredibly strong. And as I said, engagement on the service is only getting deeper. So, you know, we're very encouraged by what we can do there. And we're going to be taking really just the first step this year. I think there are also future opportunities to grow price down the road, both domestically and internationally. So that's D2C. And then with respect to your question on the dividend, you know, look, I think the capital allocation policy, the changes we made to our capital allocation policy are totally appropriate for a company that has both the compelling growth opportunity we see today, but operating in the current macro environment. There's no debate that our streaming momentum has obviously continued to build, but the reality is the macro environment has not gotten less complex. So it's prudent really for all companies to optimize their balance sheet for flexibility. And that's exactly what we're doing by reducing the quarterly dividend to 5 cents. That does translate to significant cash savings, roughly $500 million annually, as I mentioned, while still returning some capital to shareholders. And to one of the elements of your question, I would emphasize that the reduction in the dividend does not mean that we intend to spend more than previously planned on streaming. You should really think of this as the cash benefit of reducing the dividend, along with other initiatives like non-core asset sales and continued cost management, is intended to help delever our balance sheet, which is generally a smart thing to do in an uncertain macro environment, and is also a key ingredient in creating long-term shareholder value, which is, of course, the primary goal that we have.
Okay. Operator, we can take the next question.
Thank you. The next question goes to Brett Feldman of Goldman Sachs. Brett, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yeah, thank you for taking the question. Naveen, you expressed a great deal of confidence that you'll continue to see significant cash generation out of the TV media segment for a number of years. I think we all appreciate the rate dynamic that you highlighted in terms of the opportunity to continue to get good rate out of the affiliate fees. I was hoping you could go a little deeper into the P&L and talk about some of the opportunities to drive OPEX efficiencies in the business. We get a lot of questions about the flexibility to contain non-sports related content costs. And then there are any other operating costs within the P&L you think you can make headway against as you sort of grapple with the cord cutting environment? Thank you.
Yeah, sure, Brett. Thanks for the question. And as you said, that the top line dynamics are important here as well, because even though the traditional ecosystem is obviously evolving, the financial impact for us is somewhat mitigated given the combination of rate increases in both the linear advertising side and linear affiliate revenues, which offsets some of that ecosystem shift. You saw that in Q1, where linear affiliate revenue declines were just 1%, which is much lower than what you see in terms of declines in the pay TV sub base overall. But with respect to the cost base, which you specifically asked about, there are numerous levers that we continue to exercise. That includes a variety of opportunities on programming, things like continuing to evolve the mix of genres, transitioning some of our programming to lower cost formats, moving more production offshore where factor costs are significantly lower. And we're even doing things like adopting AI for content localization, which, by the way, produces some really high-quality results at very, very compelling economics. So lots to do on the programming side. Beyond programming, we're taking a highly disciplined approach to headcount and continuing to find efficiencies there, and also evolving marketing budgets where it makes sense and where we can do so efficiently. And then we're also doing some things around licensing. which is a little more revenue related, but we do see opportunities to expand our licensing business in, call it non-core international marketplace. So, you know, the way I think about it, it's really the combination of our ability to mitigate some of the ecosystem declines on the top line while also exercising a lot of these levers on the cost side, the combination of which means that TV media OIBDA will continue to be a source of significant earnings and cash flow going forward.
Operator?
Thank you. The next question goes to Ben Swinburne of Morgan Stanley. Ben, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. Good morning. Maybe for Naveen, just on the on the content spending front, you know, you talked about the dividend saving the company a lot of money, but obviously cash content spending is your biggest cash outflow. You know, can you give us any guidance on how you see cash content spending over time? That seems like another big lever. You know, could that decline? And then just back on the dividend timing, I mean, I hear you on the macro, but you guys are also talking about the ad market getting better. You just mentioned your affiliate revenues improving. You know, the ad market's been weak for a while. Were there other catalysts that the board and the management team looked at that determined this was the right time to, you know, cut the dividend by this magnitude? Because a lot of these headwinds, I think, have been around for some time now. Just wanted to see if you had any more to add. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, look, I think I'll go in the reverse order there, Ben. You know, with respect to the dividend, as I said, it really is about providing as much financial flexibility as possible and finding ways to create the most value for our shareholders. And I think having a strong balance sheet is helpful to that. And, you know, the macro environment is something that we're conscious of as we think about what the balance sheet should look like. So that is very much the motivation there. With respect to your question on content spend over time, I'd say a few things. You know, number one, really since we launched Paramount Plus, we have had a strategy which is very focused on being as efficient as possible in how we deploy cash related to content for building out streaming. If you remember, you know, we embrace the concept of sharing content across platforms to reduce cost and maximize ROI. We lean very heavily into franchises, which are fundamentally more cost efficient. We never abandoned third-party licensing, and we took a very capital efficient approach to international expansion. Now, we're always looking for ways to be even more efficient with content spend. That's one of the reasons that we decided to integrate Showtime and Paramount Plus, which, as we said last quarter, means you know, more than $700 million of future expense savings, not all of which is content. And I think I also noted at the time that that does mean D2C content expense in 2024 should actually be less than what we originally indicated. And we're not stopping there. We're pushing even harder to unlock additional savings. You know, that means an even bigger focus on franchises and some of the things that I referenced earlier, genre mix, formats, order size, looking at the special effects budget, international development, et cetera. And I think the combination of those things means we will likely find even more efficiencies in content spend across both linear and streaming than what we've assumed today.
Operator, we can take the next question.
Thank you. The next question goes to Jessica Reif Ehrlich of Bank of America Securities. Jessica, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. Maybe moving over to advertising, you've taken a different approach this year. Can you give us your current like upfront expectations? Given the macro and secular challenges, and maybe talk about like AVOD versus linear. And then, you know, on the writer's strike, you know, how prepared do you think you are, and will it potentially reduce cash spend in the, at least in the near term?
Yeah, sure, Jessica. I'll take both of those. Let me do the writer's strike first since it's a little bit shorter. start with writers are an essential part of creating content that our audiences enjoy really across platforms, and we hope we can come to a resolution that works for everyone fairly quickly. But it's also fair to say there's a pretty big gap today, and it's really a multifaceted kind of bid and ask. So obviously we've been planning for this. We do have many levers to pull, and that'll allow us to manage through the strike, even if it's for an extended duration. In terms of those levers, we have a lot in the can, so to speak, content in the can. So with the exception of things like late night, consumers really won't notice anything for a while. Add to that a broad range of reality and unscripted, where we're definitely a leader, as well as sports, and that's not affected. And so, look, we can do more in those areas if necessary. And again, we have a leadership position overall. Plus, we have offshore production, which we've been moving to leverage pre-strike anyway as part of our broader strategy, and Naveen touched on that. Plus, finally, one of the largest libraries in media, features, television series, multiple demographics, et cetera, which we can pull from to fill the schedule. So we're well positioned to navigate that. And by the way, in case, because I'm sure you're wondering, in terms of financial impact, it really ultimately depends on duration of strike. But at this point, we think it's probably slightly dilutive to revenue, flat to, on OIBDA, and accretive to your question to cash. But again, ultimately, really a function of how long it lasts. Over to the ad side, when you said we're doing something differently, you're referring to our upfront events, which I'll come to. Big picture, we feel great about our proposition to advertisers and their agencies. I've been associated with it for a long time, and frankly, I think it's the strongest it's ever been, given our differentiated platform portfolio, industry-leading creative integration, advanced advertising, a lot on alternate measurement, and, of course, our popular content, including sports. And, by the way, we have the next Super Bowl, so that's all good. We did realign our sales force in terms of doing something differently also. We realigned it so it's now easier to do business with us, particularly if you're an agency holding company where you now have a dedicated team serving you that's knowledgeable about your business and, again, can give you turnkey access. With respect to the upfront, we did a couple things differently this year. In fact, we just wrapped 9 upfront events in a new format that really strongly resonated with our clients in the room. They liked it targeting specific buyer groups. It was more intimate. It allowed for really quality two-way conversations. And that contrasts kind of with the old model of one big presentation event and then a huge party after, not really effective anymore for the day. By the way, we did it earlier. That's clearly better. And for us, it's one of those rare moves that's both more effective based on the feedback we got, and more efficient because in aggregate it costs significantly less than the old model. So we feel great about that. And again, we're in the very early stages of the upfront. I'm not going to comment on what's going on, price, volume, et cetera, because at the end of the day it's an active negotiation and it doesn't make sense to get into it live on the call. So that's it. I will say, by the way, without getting into it, we definitely have a plan here. We are executing against that plan, and I do believe that when the dust settles, we will clearly demonstrate the power of Paramount in the ad space. So feeling good about it going in.
Okay. Operator?
Thank you. The next question goes to Rich Greenfield of Lightshed Partners. Rich, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for taking the question. I got a couple. I mean, first on Paramount Plus, you're growing subs at a pretty healthy clip, leveraging a bunch of the structural deals that you've done with partners. But I'm sort of wondering about sort of the engagement side of Paramount Plus. It looks like ad revenue is still relatively small on a per-sub basis, you know, somewhat sub $2 versus your peers that are upwards of $9 or $10. And I assume that's engagement-driven. And I'm just sort of wondering, as advertising becomes a bigger part of Paramount Plus, what are you doing marketing spend or content production-wise, meaning more, to drive overall time spent per user per day on Paramount Plus? I'd love to get your sense there. And then just sort of following up on something that Bob and Naveen, you were talking about before in terms of headcount or, you know, the cost side of the equation, I think you ended last year with like 24,000 employees. I'm just wondering, as sort of you look at sort of the pressure on the on the cable network, media network, CBS, MTV, et cetera, what's the right nudge? How much lower can that go without really eating into sort of the core strength? Like, can employee count get cut in half over the next 5 years? Like, how much smaller can the employee count get? Or how do you think about reducing headcount going forward? Thanks.
Well, Naveen, why don't you start with the ad rates of D2C?
Yeah, sure. So, Rich, as it relates to your question on engagement and ad monetization, short answer is we are very bullish about the opportunity to grow ad ARPU on P+. That opportunity really begins with engagement, and we've seen really strong momentum there. In fact, if you look at our Q1 results, the viewing hours per sub actually grew double digits, both sequentially and year over year. And, I expect we'll see further growth in engagement as the content slate continues to expand, as awareness continues to grow, and frankly, as we get even better at optimizing the programming strategy, recommendations, and the like. I think there's a really interesting data point that is relevant there in the form of customers who use the current Showtime P-Plus bundle. Those customers spend about 20% more time on the service, and they watch 40% more titles than the folks in standalone Paramount Plus. So, there's clearly significant opportunity for us to continue to grow engagement, which means, significant opportunity for ad monetization, particularly when the ad market improves. Though, quite frankly, even the current trajectory is encouraging. I think domestic ad ARPU, similar to engagement, was up double digits this quarter on both a sequential and a year-over-year basis. So big value creation opportunity there.
Yeah, and going to your question about the cost side, clearly start with it's something we are very focused on as an umbrella point. If you look, and you could think, Rich, when we started this conversation 7 years ago, at the time on the cable network side, we had probably five fully built out groups organizationally programming each a set of networks. Fast forward to today, through consolidation, call it economics, we now have one kind of master cable networks group here in the U.S., and I'm going to come back to the international side in a second, and they're running all the networks with a slight exception, and we're in the middle of effectuating the latest step on that, which is the Showtime consolidation into effectively the U.S. cable group. And so there's all kind of economic savings there, and we continue to ask the question of how can we extract more from operating a set of networks as a portfolio managed in a single group. And that goes to organization, that goes to how we use content, that goes to cross-promo, et cetera. And again, we've seen significant benefit along the way, and we think there is further road to go. And right now, we're just in the middle of integrating Showtime. And if you look at, for example, what we did with Your Honor most recently, we launched that show on the back of this second season, on the back of what we call the Yellowstone Launchpad on Paramount Network. That was much easier to do as we integrated the structure into one than it was previously. And those are the kind of things we'll continue to mine. As you look outside the U.S. and the international, there's two things you should know, again, going to the cost. One is we've now globalized management of those networks. So Chris's team is ultimately thinking about how can we run that whole portfolio more efficiently and effectively. And related to that, we are going from a place where you have country-specific feeds to, in a way, it's back to the future. It's shared feeds with local opt-outs and multiple language tracks, which has all kind of efficiencies. So there is I'm not going to get into what the specific headcount could be, but rest assured that is something we are very focused on, and we will continue to extract benefits as we go forward.
Okay. Operator, we can take the next question.
Thank you. The next question goes to Robert Fishman of MoffettNathanson. Robert, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, good morning. I got one for Bob and one related one for Naveen. First, Bob, can you give us your latest thoughts on keeping your key IP exclusive to your own platforms instead of selling it off to third parties? And specifically, maybe speak to selling the SpongeBob spinoff movie to Netflix, whether we should interpret that as like a shift away from keeping content exclusive to Paramount Plus. And then for Naveen, how much does licensing content to third parties or the international licensing you called out earlier help in terms of getting back to that free cash flow positive next year?
Yeah, sure, Robert. So look, there's been fundamentally no change to our views on content licensing. In general, we believe in a balanced strategy with two key components: keeping our franchise content for our owned and operated platforms on a first window basis. We think that's a real strategic advantage. It certainly drives subscribers, and you've seen that to great effect with Paramount Plus. But at the same time, and we used to be an outlier here, other people are pivoting back to the rationality of the approach, we do believe in monetizing content, mostly library content, on a co-exclusive or non-exclusive basis with third parties, because the fact is it generates incremental revenues, incremental margins, incremental franchise impressions, which are good for that, and doesn't really adversely affect subscriber acquisition on the O&O side. Yes, there we do things from time to time, particularly in international markets with a franchise. Remember, Paramount Plus isn't fully penetrated yet on a global basis. It's very much, we're in 9 of the top 10 streaming markets, but the world's a pretty big place, as you know. So content licensing can be very important on a rest of world basis. But the main thing is we haven't changed our point of view on licensing. We believe in this dual model of core IP and franchises to drive O&O, particularly streaming, combined with a broader licensing strategy. And we continue to evaluate opportunities against that that framework, including we believe there are some broader licensing opportunities that have financial upside. But that's licensing. Naveen?
Rob, with respect to sort of the financial impact of that, particularly the international component, obviously we're not going to give you any specific numbers there, though I'd say a few things. Number one, that business is a high margin business, and so it can be a nice contributor. It's largely about licensing stuff that has already been produced for other channels. So unlike the original production business, which is a little lower margin, this one can be a nice contributor, and I suspect it'll grow over time. More importantly, there are multiple drivers for earnings and free cash flow growth in 24. And I think it's important to remember what those are and the potential that they have. We talked about them last quarter, and they continue to apply. We're expecting to see significant growth in Paramount Plus subscribers and ARPU, i.e. revenue growth. We're tracking nicely in terms of the integration of Showtime and Paramount Plus, which unlocks both top-line benefits as well as significant savings in content in other places. That does mean you'll see slowing growth in streaming content spend, as well as marketing efficiencies that we get through content leverage, more utilization of promotional inventory, et cetera. So those are the big drivers into 24, and we remain confident in what we'll deliver there.
Operator, we can take another question.
Thank you. The next question goes to Doug Mitchelson of Credit Suisse. Doug, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thanks so much for taking the question. So I guess I'm curious, are there other assets that you're considering selling beyond Simon & Schuster? It was just sort of unclear from the preamble if you were thinking more broadly there. And then Naveen, on the positive free cash flow 2024, I was just hoping you could outline the bridge, and you kind of just mentioned part of it on DTC. Is it as simple as flowing through EBITDA growth, or are there other drivers of free cash flow beyond operating growth? Thanks so much.
Yeah, Doug, I'll speak to the asset sales and throw it to Naveen. Look, we're always looking for ways to maximize shareholder value. That might involve divesting, acquiring, or potentially partnering on an asset. And by the way, we've done all three of those things, so we look at everything. As I indicated in, you know, in my remarks, we are now back in the market with Simon & Schuster. We feel very good about the value creation opportunity there, given both its operating performance, which is substantially superior to what it was when we brought it to the market before, and frankly, the level of buyer interest. There's a lot of interest, so we feel good about that. And depending on who the ultimate buyer ends up being, we see what type of buyer, really, we see a path to potentially closing that deal this year. I'm not going to comment on any other speculative, there's a bunch of speculation out there, transactions, what we might or might do, other than, again, to reinforce, we are always looking for ways to maximize shareholder value. Naveen?
Yeah, and Doug, with respect to your question on free cash flow, you know, I think I just took you through some of the sort of operational levers, if you will, that will drive the business into 24. If you think about it through more just a pure financial lens, yes, OIBDA improvement is a big contributor to the improvement that we expect to see in free cash flow. But there are also benefits from a working capital perspective. You know, we've talked about this dynamic where over the last few years, as we've ramped up in streaming, you saw significant growth in sort of cash content spend. And then it takes a little while for the expense side of that to the P&L side of that to show up because of the nature of amortization. What you will see going into 24 and beyond is actually that the cash content growth really starts to slow very significantly. You know, you start to get to a place where the rate of growth in cash content and P&L expense will start to converge. But there's going to be real benefits from a working capital perspective over the next couple of years because of those dynamics.
Okay. Operator, we can take our last question.
Thank you. Our final question goes to Phil Cusick of J.P. Morgan. Phil, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you for getting me in. You know, I heard the comment around lower content costs in 24 for DTC. How should we think about your 24 goals around revenue and subscribers given the Showtime integration? And then maybe, Naveen, you and I have talked about this before, but how is retail churn trending in the Paramount Plus space, both overall and as the cohorts mature? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. So first, with respect to 24 goals, you know, we talked about this a little bit on our last call. You know, we continue to be very bullish about D2C growth overall. You know, there are some puts and takes in terms of what's going on in terms of the ad market, but, you know, we're, I would say, ahead of our plans with respect to Paramount Plus growth, subs, revenue, et cetera. I noted that with respect to content expense, the integration of Showtime and Paramount Plus, we think does put us in a position where we'll actually be spending less in 2024 than we originally indicated. So, you know, I think in general, we continue to be very excited about the trajectory of the D2C business relative to our plans. Regarding the question on retail churn characteristics, I think the short answer is churn continues to improve. We saw that in Q1, and it's been a pretty consistent theme as we see really nice improvements in engagement. The content portfolio continues to expand. We get you know, more partnerships in place. All of those things are beneficial from a churn perspective, and that's definitely one of the key ingredients that's going to drive revenue growth going forward. So we like what we're seeing there.
Yeah, and with that, in closing, look, I want to emphasize that we have momentum, and importantly, we have conviction. So we're going to focus on driving market-leading streaming growth while navigating this dynamic macroeconomic environment. and know that the decisions we're making will position us well for our path to streaming profitability, significant earnings growth, and a return to positive cash flow, free cash flow in 2024. So we're laser-focused. Thank you, everyone. We appreciate your support, and be well. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. This now concludes today's call. Thank you so much for joining. You may now disconnect your lines.